This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The westernmost divisions are a baseball honcho's dreams. The pennant races there have failed to knock out any teams. In other venues, races aren't as close as races get. And in the NL East, nobody's challenging the Mets. Joining me now to spare everyone from any more doggerel is Tim Kirkjian of ESPN and ESPN the magazine. Tim, are you disappointed that the Barry Bonds saga did not get resolved via a grand jury this week?
Well, I'd just like to see an end to this story, Bill, for everybody's sake, for Barry's sake, for the Giants' sake, but mostly for baseball's sake, because I just sense now that people are really getting tired of this. I mean, this is just dragging on and on, and I have a feeling we're not even close to being the end of this story. And, you know, I think there's going to be an indictment perhaps someday, but the fact that it didn't come this week suggests perhaps that it's not coming anytime soon. And, you know, this is a baseball player. This is not the most important thing in the world. You know, his numbers are going to live, Bill. They're not going to take him away. And people just have to understand that, you know, we understand what's going on here. We need to give our baseball fans, our good ones, a little bit more credit here, that this is not life and death, that this guy continues to hit home runs. You know, there's going to be a story attached to this guy no matter what, and we're all going to know a lot more than we know now eventually, but I think it's time we started to move on a little bit, but that's not going to happen.
When you say people are getting tired of this story, do we eventually get to a point where everybody gets so tired of it that they just don't care who used what when?
Well, I think we're getting to that point, and I think the fact that everyone was involved in this whole steroid controversy, that is, Major League Baseball not doing enough, the media not doing enough, general managers turning the other way, I just think sometimes it's better to just acknowledge that this period here, this 10-year period, this 12-year period, whatever you want to call it, we all got it wrong, and historians are going to count it, and it's going to be there for the rest of time. But to go back and try to figure all this out, I just don't know if that's going to happen. Sometimes I think we should just move on, and yet I want more answers. I vote for the Hall of Fame. I need to know exactly what happened here, but unfortunately, I don't think I'm ever going to find out exactly what happened, and that is unfortunate.
Let's move on to some actual baseball, Tim, and look at the American League Central, where the Detroit Tigers have withstood a charge from the defending world champion Chicago White Sox. The Tigers have expanded their lead. We established last time we talked, you and I, that the Tigers are a legitimate playoff contender. Do we dare suggest that this team that lost 119 games less than 3 years ago can actually win the World Series?
The Tigers can win the World Series, Bill, and this, for me, is the kind of story we should be talking about, because this is a great baseball story. This team was horrible a few years ago. They weren't very good coming into this season, according to most people, and yet you put a fiery new manager in there who happens to be 61 years old, you get a bunch of kids who throw 100 miles an hour, and you go for it, and you revitalize a baseball town that had lost interest in the game, even though it's been playing baseball for over 100 years. This is a great baseball story, and given, you know, the relative parity in both leagues, really good teams in the American League and a lot of really bad teams in the National League, the Tigers can win the World Series. And this week was a huge week for them because they beat the White Sox. One of their nemesis twice came from behind in each game. And it's a wonderful story. And I think they're not done dealing either. I think they're going to go out and get another player before the July 31st trade deadline to show people we're just not interested in making the playoffs. We want to win the whole thing. And here's how aggressive we're going to be at doing that.
Well, since you've brought up the trade deadline at the end of the month, talk to me a little more about other trades that you anticipate and who benefits.
Well, I think we're going to see Alfonso Soriano of the Nationals move. In fact, I think the Nationals are at the center of all trade activity because they have Soriano. They have Jose Guillen, even though he's on the DL. They have pitcher Leivan Hernandez. They have two other pitchers, Tony Armas and Ramon Ortiz, that they're willing to deal. They're basically willing to deal about 20 of their 25 players. And it's just a question of who's going to be interested. Now, clearly, a bunch of teams are interested in Alfonso Soriano because he's going to be a 30-30 40 guy, maybe a 40-40 guy this year, depending how he finishes. And he can really help a team, and he can really help the Nationals in a trade because he can bring them two young players that they really need to restock their system. I think all trades go through Washington. Otherwise, I think it's a pretty quiet market. So to me, whoever gets Soriano may be able to take that big step from, you know, pretender to contender, or from contender to a team that might even win the World Series.
Tim, unbelievably, it's been, I think, 3 months since you and I have talked about the Red Sox and the Yankees. The Yankees have no pitching, suspect defense, terrible injury problems all season long, but the Red Sox can't put any distance between themselves and the Yankees anyway. Can the Yankees win the AL East again?
Yes, I think they can. I don't think they will. I think the Red Sox are going to hang on because the Red Sox have two terrific starting pitchers and a terrific closer and a terrific defense. You put all that together, I think that's going to be enough to win the American League East. However, the Yankees, as you said, Bill, have had everything possible go wrong for them this year, and they are still right there. That should be a really bad sign for all the teams in the American League. The question, though, is, are they going to get Hideki Matsui and Gary Sheffield healthy enough in September to continue this run? Are they going to pitch well enough to get to the middle of September and still be in this thing? These are big questions. And at this moment, I'm guessing the Yankees are not going to make the playoffs. And I can't believe I'm saying that. You can't underestimate the Yankees under any circumstance. But right now, they've got a long way to go to make the playoffs.
Tim Kirkjian covers Major League Baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine. Tim, thanks again.
My pleasure, Bill.
Next weekend's National Baseball Hall of Fame induction ceremony will feature former Major League relief pitcher Bruce Sutter and 17 Negro Leaguers elected by a special committee in February. But since then, there's been more attention paid to the icon who will be at the podium to present the Negro League stars, because even though he was one of the 39 up for consideration, he was not elected. Only a Game's Greg Eklund reports from Kansas City.
Can I get a quick picture with you, Bob?
You can.
94-year-old Buck O'Neill boasts a batting average of .288 for his playing career, which began in 1937 and ended in 1950. In 1948, he became a player coach with the Kansas City Monarchs, which he led to 5 pennants and 2 Black World Series victories. His Negro League's managing career ended in 1955, after which he became the first Black Major League Baseball coach with the Chicago Cubs.
Hey, what you got here?
We got a little dog.
O'Neill had been under consideration for the Baseball Hall of Fame, but was not included among the Special Committee's 2006 inductees. On a recent Sunday afternoon at a Kansas City Royals home game, during which the Royals and the Milwaukee Brewers wore throwback uniforms to salute the Negro Leagues, fans responded to the omission of Buck O'Neill.
Of the Negro Leaguers who are going into the Baseball Hall of Fame, who do you know about the most?
Well, of course, Buck O'Neill, but he was one that didn't make it.
Now, when you heard of the announcement for the Negro Leaguers going into the Baseball Hall of Fame, what were your thoughts that day?
That Buck was going to make it, but he didn't.
Yeah, I feel good about it. They did elect a lot of members, a lot of new people. So, but Buck wasn't one of them, and I just don't think it was right. He's done a lot for baseball.
Now, on this special day, please join us in welcoming back to the playing field former Kansas City Monarchs and Negro Leagues veterans, George Altman.
Of the 39 candidates previously under consideration by a committee of 12 Negro League historians, only Buck O'Neill and Minnie Minoso are living, but O'Neill is easily the most well-known.
And your Kansas City favorite, Buck O'Neill.
One would assume that Buck O'Neill's chairmanship of the Negro League's Baseball Museum would create a bit of a conflict for him, but he's been characteristically graceful in keeping the spotlight off himself.
No, I'm going to see that it won't, because I'm going to be the spokesman for these guys.
And the feeling he anticipates when he's at the induction ceremony podium next week?
Ooh, I'm going to be so happy. Yeah, glad to finally putting these guys in there.
Black baseball changed forever when Robinson brought down the cover there.
Buck O'Neill can often be found at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City and elsewhere, eagerly sharing stories about Satchel Paige's hesitation pitch, cool Papa Bell's speed, and Josh Gibson's power. But according to researcher Larry Lester, who served on the 12-member selection committee, there's a danger that the folklore surrounding those great players could overshadow lesser-known Negro Leaguers, including Buck O'Neill.
Some people think that because these players are so amazing and so incredible, that these stories really are not true. They're mythical. But they've overlooked a couple of dozen more ball players who are equally as great, but less flashier. And that's the problem. You know, there's so many great stories about these unknown, unheralded, unappreciated legends. And we need to educate the public. That's why we have this conference.
Yeah, I'm ready to go when everybody's ready.
The annual Jerry Molloy Negro Leagues Conference took place on July 7th in Kansas City in conjunction with what is believed to have been Satchel Paige's 100th birthday. Ray Doswell, a curator at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum and also a member of the special committee, was one of the presenters at the meeting. He later said he wasn't surprised at the backlash in the wake of O'Neill's exclusion, but he was surprised that the backlash has lasted for almost 6 months.
Many are still very upset about the situation. I'd say the same in regards to Manny Manoso, who so many people love as well. Is certainly worthy of consideration for the Hall of Fame. But for Mr. O'Neill and how much he is admired around the country among baseball fans, among baseball enthusiasts, among baseball historians, the backlash has been rather long and protracted.
The special committee was disbanded after last February's announcement of the 17 Cooperstown Hall of Fame inductees. It may have been the last hope for Buck O'Neill, Manny Manoso, and other Negro League greats. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Kansas City.
This is a bad news, Satch. We're putting you in.
I hear your mama. Hey, hey. He's got the beat ball, jump ball, screwball, switch, got the hesitant.
Yesterday's Stage 18 of the Tour de France did nothing to change the leaderboard. Going into today's time trials, Spaniard Oscar Pereiro held the yellow jersey, with countryman Carlos Sastre 12 seconds behind. American Floyd Landis, squishy hip and all, was in third place. The final stage takes place tomorrow, ending in Paris's Champs-Élysées.
That's the secret of life, the secret of Satchel.
They all thought I was the best. How come they never give me no justice?
It's 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, surfing as a means by which to meld neurobiology and mysticism. Really. But first, for the 11,000 Americans who suffer spinal cord injuries each year, the adjustment to life in a wheelchair can be extremely difficult. But for some spinal cord injury victims in Southern California, rising to that challenge has gotten a bit easier, thanks to a group that provides a chance to get out of the wheelchair and into the surf. Arizona Public Radio's Jillian Ferris-Cole has the story from Huntington Beach, California.
It's a busy morning at Bolsa Chica State Beach. Amidst the usual runners and sunbathers is a group of about 40 teenagers who've gathered near the lifeguard tower for a high school graduation party. But two of the boys soon wander away from the group towards the ocean, drawn to a small cluster of surfers scanning the waves. The boys can't believe what they're seeing as they watch 11-year-old Patrick Iveson ride wave after wave on his longboard. Patrick sits on top of the board with his legs out in front of him. A helper sits behind him, holding Iveson in a big bear hug.
That's real crazy. I can't understand how you're going to be out there surfing. Don't you need your legs or be able to move your legs to stand up? That's crazy.
I could barely even swim, so they doing that, that's pretty tight, that's pretty crazy.
Crazy only if you believe a quadriplegic kid can't surf. But Patrick can surf thanks to a program called They Will Surf Again, or TWSA, a grassroots effort to get people into the ocean and onto surfboards after suffering spinal cord injuries.
We'll get 5 to 7 volunteers around each participant, and we'll line them out into the water.
That's Richard Yellen, director of TWSA. He says surfers with disabilities are no different than any other surfers. All they really need is a board, some good waves, and a few friends to make it happen.
We'll have a couple people take the person through the surf line, And then we'll have stage couple, two people, one person on either side, all the way in, kind of lining from outside to inside. And they'll ride the wave along that route of people. And then if they fall, one person or two is ready to grab them at any time.
They Will Surf Again is an arm of the Life Rolls On Foundation, a nonprofit group that raises funds for spinal cord research. The foundation was spearheaded several years ago by professional surfer Jesse Billauer, a quadriplegic himself after a surfing accident 10 years ago. Billauer's foundation now organizes about 6 events a year along the West Coast, where anywhere from 1 to 30 surfers with disabilities takes to the water.
I know how much surfing means to me and how peaceful it is and how relaxing and how independent I feel. So I wanted to kind of give back and get a bunch of other people in wheelchairs out in the water. And to me, being at the beach, looking at the water, that's a peaceful state of mind.
The soft-spoken and serene Billauer says his friends were more nervous than he was 8 years ago when he asked for their help to surf again. Together, they figured out a system of towing, then pushing Jesse into waves, allowing him to ride on his belly, then turn into waves with his forearms. Now Billauer's foundation provides water volunteers for a growing number of surfers with spinal cord injuries. Huntington Beach native Danny Miskin is one of the volunteers who helped 11-year-old Patrick Iveson during his morning surf session.
You just got to realize that he can't move his head and his arms or whatnot, so you can't lay him flat on the board because the water will get in his, you know, mouth and whatnot, so we got to keep him sitting up the whole time. I pretty much had him in a bear hug. The kid's positive. He's one of the toughest kids I've ever met.
Patrick became paralyzed when he was 14 months old, just 4 months after taking his first steps.
My mom and I were walking behind a car, and she just set me down to walk for a second, and in that second, the car backed up and hit me and ran me over.
Patrick gets help shoving his sandy blonde mohawk underneath the hood of his sweatshirt and says even though he was a toddler at the time of his injury, he never stopped dreaming of learning how to surf.
I vaguely remember going to the ocean like, whoa, waves, cool. That's me. I'm doing that, yeah. Going surfing. So I've been surfing now for about 3-4 years. I'm always nervous before I go out surfing. Like, gotta check out the waves before I go so I don't get killed. And when I get out there, I'm like, why did I worry, man? I mean, it's fun. It feels like you're flying pretty much.
That feeling of freedom is what draws many surfers to the ocean, including 23-year-old Corey Town, who found surfing about a year after his spinal cord injury.
3 years ago, October 19th, I was up in Santa Cruz for a concert, and I climbed a redwood tree to meet a girl, and I stepped on a branch, and it broke, and I fell about 60 feet and broke my back.
Town talks about his accident with one eye always on the ocean, watching for perfect sets. Once a semi-professional soccer player, Town says he wanted to get back into sports immediately after his injury, but he just couldn't bring himself to join a wheelchair soccer league.
It's a complete mockery of my sport, and I can't handle it. It's like hockey-sized goals with, like, beach ball, even triple the size of beach ball-sized balls, and just, it makes me sad. So I found surfing. It's the only thing that's given me the exhilaration is, you know, the same as scoring a goal.
Town is paralyzed from the waist down, but he's got enough upper body strength to paddle out past the breakers and then right back into them. He says cleaning his house and trying to push around his college campus every day are much harder than getting pounded by the ocean, which is exactly where he and his water helpers are headed right now.
Hey, there's some fun little lefts out there. Look at that.
Hell yeah.
It's lined up pretty well.
That'll
work. It's a little bit bumpy, but there's potential.
I just want to get wet and get some waves.
For Only a Game, I'm Jillian Ferris-Cole in Huntington Beach, California.
West of Jesus, subtitled Surfing Science and the Origins of Belief, is an ambitious exploration of many things, various states of consciousness, for example, and the function of myth in different cultures. The author, Stephen Kotler, has found in surfing a route into anthropology, psychology, religion, mysticism, and maybe even self-awareness. Stephen Kotler joins me now from the studios of NPR West in Los Angeles. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
The book begins with your contention that you went to Mexico to surf, quote, because the stories I told myself had begun to fail. What happened to deprive your repertoire of stories that had power and meaning?
Well,
My earliest childhood belief was this sneaking suspicion that the world was a much more mysterious place than people were letting on. And by the time I got to college, that had turned into a full-blown Jonathan Livingston Siegelitis. Mm. So at the end of my sophomore year, I dropped out and I moved to Santa Fe because the New Age was booming. And over the course of the next couple of years, it was ashrams and monasteries and strange chants and strange mushrooms and shaman. And when it was all said and done, I could sit in the full lotus for about 5-6 hours at a time, and I never once achieved a mystical anything. Mm. So I decided it was all hokey, it was all nonsense, and I became a science geek, a really hardcore rational materialist. I dove into science writing and science journalism, and to me, medicine was the apogee of all of this. And in 2000, I got Lyme disease, and a couple years later, the miracle of modern medicine had completely failed me. I was still deathly ill. The doctors had kind of thrown up their hands. There's not a whole lot you can do with chronic Lyme. And, you know, my last remaining belief, which was in, you know, in all this science stuff, kind of was ripped from me. So there was really nothing left at that particular point.
One of the things that you found when you had run out of stories was a mysterious tale about a figure called the Conductor. And since that tale in some ways provides the spine of West of Jesus, maybe you'd better tell it.
Well, the really short version is the Conductor is a surfer who controls the waves and the weather. He conducts the waves with a baton made of human bone.
And you heard that story twice.
I did. I heard it in very different places. I heard it the first time back in 1996. I was in Indonesia. I was a novice surfer. I had kind of met a group of Australians who actually kept me out of jail, but that's a long story and it's in the book. but they kept me out of jail, and I got them really drunk to say thank you, and they convinced me to go surf this place called Nusa Dua. I knew nothing about it, and it was a big day when we got out there, and I definitely shouldn't have been out there, and a very big wave landed on me, and seven more landed on me, and the reef is really close under the water, and I was bloody. I was puking water when it was all said and done, and I kind of was anchored outside the reef trying to recover, and an Australian guy who I met down there had paddled over to me, and he was like, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Well, you know, except for the bleeding and the puking, I'm just fine, thanks." He said, "Yeah, it looks like the Conductor had his way with you." And 9 years later, in 2003, I was in Mexico surfing hurricane swell. Again, I was over my head. I shouldn't have been doing it. And again, I got mauled and mashed by a bunch of waves and a bunch of rocks, and I was recovering on the boat. And this surfer I met down there named Ben, who was from New York, paddled over to me and said, "Hey, man, looks like the Conductor had his way with you." And that's when it caught my attention.
Why did you choose sports, and specifically surfing, as a way of understanding various aspects of neuroscience and exploring myths and mysticism? Because there were all number of routes that might have been open to you in that.
Well, what happened to me is I had been in bed for a good couple years, and I was about as despondent as you could possibly get, and I was really considering suicide very, very, very seriously. And a friend of mine called and said, "Let's go surfing." And I just started laughing because it was this ridiculous request. I could barely walk across the room, let alone go surfing. But she was really insistent, and I figured, you know what? I can always kill myself tomorrow. I'll go surfing today. It was unlike any of my Northern California early surf experiences. The waves were soft. The water was warm. And I got out there, had this huge board, and I sat down on it. And 30 seconds later, a wave came. And it certainly was all muscle memory. I didn't, you know, I could barely stand up. It was ridiculous. But I caught that wave, and for the first time in a couple of years, I really wanted to be alive. It was an astounding, astounding feeling. And I caught four more waves. That's how excited I was. And after those waves, I was completely disassembled. They had to drive me back to my apartment and put me to bed, and I was in bed for a couple of weeks. Hmm. And on the 15th day, I got out and I went surfing again. And over a period of time, I started to feel better. But more mysterious than that, over this period of time, I started to believe in surfing like it was a new religion. And that didn't make any sense to me. All of it was weird. I didn't know why I was surfing myself back to health. Surfing's not found in the normal cures of Lyme disease. And I didn't know why I was believing in this sport of surfing. I mean, it felt like aquatic hippie nonsense to me. But when I heard the Conductor's tale that second time, here was this story with all this myth and this magic, and it was a surfing story. And I didn't know what this myth and magic was doing in this surfing story, just like I didn't know what was going on with me. And I thought, huh, maybe if I track this legend back to its point of origin, it'll give me a little bit of a window into what's going on with me.
A considerable portion of West of Jesus is about people who suddenly find themselves doing things they know they cannot do, such as you returning to surfing, I suppose. But perhaps you would read from page 183 to give our listeners a sense of how that happened to you one day when you were out in a surf that you really knew you couldn't handle.
I watched the wall set up, the water sock off the bottom, the curl begin to pitch. There was nowhere to go, and I was certain to fall. But I didn't fall. Somehow I sucked my knees towards my chest and floated across the closeout, dropping off the far end and into the next section of the wave. I made that section, and then strung together a complicated series of maneuvers, despite the fact that I had never done any of them before, nor had I any idea how to do them. All of this was just happening. It was clearly impossible. Mine might be a world where I knew who was on the other end of the phone before I answered it, or what song was playing on the radio before the radio had been turned on. These, at least, were the kinds of anomalous events familiar to many. But a world where time slowed, where sound vanished, where vision worked in 360 degrees and I could really surf, this was an entirely new species of juju.
Now, given the perspective of time and dry land, can you explain that experience?
Well, I actually can, and the piece to that puzzle was solved by Malcolm Gladwell in his book Blink, where he interviewed a psychologist who had done a lot of work with cops in extreme high-pressure situations during gunfights and things like that. Mm. And one of the things that cops repeatedly report is that they often don't hear the sound of the guns firing, even though they're firing right beside their heads or they're firing the weapons themselves, and they can see their bullets entering the subject. And what you have to remember here is we don't actually interact with the real world. Our senses take in data, and then the brain shows us that data. So everything we see is first mitigated by the brain. And a couple of things happen in adrenaline situations like that. One of them is that the blood moves away from all the organs that are not crucial in that moment to the fight or flight thing. So one of the things that happens is blood moves away from the ears, thus the experience of sound funneling away and everything getting very, very quiet. The other thing that happens is the brain, because you're in a crisis situation, just slows things down for you. You see things at a much more slow playback rate. It's imagine, you know, a VCR or a tape like that. It's just on super slow play.
Mm. You surmise that, and I'm quoting this phrase, pinpoint concentration is one element necessary to triggering this particular state. Does pinpoint concentration come into surfing regularly, or is it only when you find yourself in a situation where, refer to your situation, holy cow, if I don't surf out of this situation, I'm going to get crushed and smashed into the reef and never come up?
Well, I'll answer that question, and I'll take it one step farther. One of the things about riding a wave that we know is it requires the exact same pinpoint focus that meditation does. But one of the things that this pinpoint focus tends to do is it produces an experience that surfers refer to as feeling one with the ocean, which, again, that's more aquatic hippie nonsense for you. But what we now know about this feeling of oneness is kind of peculiar. There's a neuroscientist named Andrew Newberg. He's the head of nuclear medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And Dr. Newberg got very, very curious about what was going on in the brains of Tibetan monks and Franciscan nuns during moments of peak meditation or peak experience. So what Dr. Newberg did is he used a SPECT scanner, which is a really, really good piece of brain imaging technology. And he took pictures of the brains of Franciscan nuns and Tibetan Buddhists during moments of, you know, peak meditation. And what he found a lot of stuff that I won't talk about. One of the things he did find that a spot above the right ear called the right parietal lobe goes really, really quiet. The right parietal lobe is the part of the brain that helps the self orientate itself in space. Well, one of the things that the brain does every millisecond is ask these basic safety and security questions. Where am I? What's going on? What's new? What's different? The where am I question gets asked to the right parietal lobe because that's its job. And after a certain point when the right parietal lobe isn't going to respond, a feedback loop is going to develop and the brain is kind of going to panic and demand an answer. But because the right parietal lobe is shut down at this moment in time, it can't tell the difference between self and other. So when it answers that question, it's going to have no choice but to tell the brain that at this particular moment in time, you are one with everything. So this, you know, what 10 years ago scientists would have told you was nonsense at best and psychosis at worst, and what 5 years ago, you know, surfers would have called aquatic hippie nonsense, turns out is neither. Turns out it's just standard biology.
You begin and end the book with that reference we spoke of a few minutes ago to Joan Didion's contention that we tell ourselves stories in order to live. Is it too melodramatic to suggest that in the process of turning up the material that became West of Jesus, you found the stories that would enable you to continue to live?
I think that is exactly what happened. Something all of life is in a certain level about creating mythologies about ourselves and trying to become those mythologies or not becoming those mythologies. The little kid in his driveway shooting hoops, dreaming of being Michael Jordan, what's he doing? He's creating a mythology for himself, and he's going to drive towards that mythology, you know, until he either, you know, fails and gives up on it or succeeds. That's essentially, you know, what we do in this life. I ran out of stories, and then I created a whole new batch.
Stephen Kotler is the author of West of Jesus, subtitled Surfing Science and the Origins of Belief, published by Bloomsbury. He spoke to me from the studios of NPR West in Los Angeles. Stephen, thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
If you'd like to hear my unexpurgated conversation with Stephen Kotler about his new book, West of Jesus, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com, and Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at bicon.com, bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Having retired so long ago that she'd forgotten she'd done it, Martina Navratilova retires again. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Floyd Landis may or may not win the Tour de France tomorrow, but on Thursday he submitted a ride that cycling enthusiasts will remember for a long time, no?
Well, if cycling enthusiasts manage to get themselves off the ceiling long enough to talk about it. According to his sports director on his cycling team, Landis was, quote, like a wounded lion. He wanted to take out the spine in his back and show the world who he was.
Mm.
Yeah, except if he took the spine out of his back, he would show the world that he was sort of a lump on the floor, wouldn't he? he had literally fallen all the way out of the top 10 and then came back and put himself in third with 30 seconds back and in position to win the race. The cycling writers got, in the immortal words of the late Frank Zappa, gooey, dripping, steaming over this, but this was really quite a performance.
The British Open is, of course, underway as we speak, Charlie. Based on Tiger's first two rounds, can anybody catch him?
Well, let's assume, number one, he's not going to shoot 85 either Saturday or Sunday. I think if they actually do carve the names on the old claret jug, they're up to about the E in Tiger by now.
At least one professional soccer organization is not blaming coach Bruce Arena for the fact that the U.S. team didn't make it to the second round of play in the World Cup. The New York Red Bulls have hired Arena as their head coach, and he's 1-0 so far, so I guess it worked.
I guess the Red Bulls are thinking, what the heck, we finished last without this guy, we can probably finish last with him. If I were cruel, though, if I were the coach of the next opponent of the Red Bulls, I would dress my team up in Ghana team shirts.
July is always the time for some good hockey talk, Charlie, so let's discuss how well Garth Snow will make the transition from goalie to general manager for the New York Islanders.
I personally think it's a creative thing about the NHL of hiring people named Snow,
mm-hmm.
because Chris Snow, a colleague of mine at the Boston Globe, is the new director of stick and puck operations for the Minnesota Wild, and now we have Garth Snow, a goalie, and a backup goalie at that, taking a job with the Islanders after Neil Smith held a job. For 40 days, the Islanders have been left in such rubble by the departure of previous GM Mike Milbury. You might as well get creative, because otherwise you could, you know, as we said earlier on the Bruce Arena story, you could finish last with a retread, or you can finish last being innovative.
On Thursday, Brazilian hoopster Nene signed a six-year, $60 million contract with the Denver Nuggets. Is this a reward for Nene's stellar 2005-2006 season, or had the Nuggets and Knicks taken part in some sort of summer exchange program for general managers?
Well, he played 3 minutes last year.
Three excellent.
I mean, he blew out his knee the first game they played. But I liked Mark Warkentin, the Nuggets director of player personnel. Nene said he wants to spend his entire career with Denver. He said, I want to be like Karl Malone. And Mark Warkentin said, we'd like you to be like Karl Malone, too.
Steve Nash showed up at a basketball camp this week with a buzz cut. So do we see basketball's version of Samson's collapse next season?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I'm really happy that Steve Nash made parole, because this is quite a haircut he got. He said he didn't have a rhyme or reason. He just felt like taking it off. Okay, we'll see how that, as we said, I guarantee you the first time he goes 3 for 19, it starts growing back again.
Elsewhere in basketball, in Las Vegas to be precise, the U.S. team that will compete in the World Championships in Japan next month has begun practicing. How do you like that aggregation?
It's an interesting bunch, actually. Chris Bosh has played his way onto the team. Bruce Bowen is on there primarily as a defensive specialist. They've got a lot of speed. You've got Joe Johnson and Sean Marion, who once ran together with Phoenix, running together again. You've got Dwayne Wade stepping in as really the leader of the team. And LeBron, you know, you've got LeBron James, Carmelo Anthony, and Dwayne Wade, all three members of the class a couple of years ago, who have sort of taken over the league's presence. And of course, you have the inevitable J.J. Redick, who may actually be a much better international player than he will be in the NBA.
So the question is, does this team save the U.S. from shame, at least on the basketball court?
Well, we'll see. I mean, they're in a pretty decent group. The Italians are in Group D with them, as are the Puerto Ricans and the Chinese. So what you're seeing put together again here, I think, is a very aggressive, rather young, kind of defensive-oriented bunch.
One more basketball matter on the agenda, Charlie. Am I correct in concluding that somewhere in the Sooner State there are some people who have to be shown that Oklahoma City can't support two NBA teams?
Well, an Oklahoma City group led by a guy named Clay Bennett bought the Seattle Supersonics on Tuesday. They insist they want to keep the team in Seattle. You know, although I did like the fact that they had their press conference at the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum, they say they're going to try to work with Seattle to replace or renovate Key Arena. So right now, the idea of the Supersonics coming to Oklahoma City seems to be a bit down the road. But I think it's fairly safe to say that Oklahoma City is much closer to having an NBA franchise than it was 2 years ago.
As you know, Charlie, I am always intrigued by people trying to set records. Michel Fournier is about to attempt to establish the mark for free falls.
Yes, 130,000 feet above the plains of Saskatchewan. This is probably something you shouldn't do above, say, Manhattan Island or Chicago. He's found some open spaces. He's 62 years old. He's a parachutist. He used to be in the military. He will break four records in the course of doing this. He will break the altitude record for free fall, the time record for the longest free fall, the speed record. That would be fairly obvious, I think, if you jumped out of a balloon.
Yes,
130,000 feet up, you're going to go pretty fast whether you want to or not. And the altitude record for human balloon flight.
Mm-hmm.
I leave it to you to pick out who your favorite human balloon is. But in this case, Mr. Fournier is going for four entries in the record book.
Strikes me as the kind of record-setting attempt that you'd better get right the first time. And finally, Charlie, we have talked previously about increased security measures for events like the World Series, the World Cup, the Olympics. But would you agree that for the 2008 Games, China will outdo all previous efforts?
Well, they're making sure that the bad people don't get their hands on their cabbages, their carrots, and their peas, because they're putting an identity number and putting it on file. They're giving you a number and taking away your salad.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
To send comments about what you've heard on Only a Game, pinpoint provocative podcasts, rifle through our voluminous audio archives, or see what our cameras have captured when we've been in the field, please visit onlyagame.org. On Saturday morning, having played doubles and mixed doubles for the Boston Lobsters of World Team Tennis the previous evening, Martina Navratilova sat at a table in a bookstore in Harvard Square. She signed copies of her new book until they were gone, and then she posed for pictures with her fans, who were numerous and enthusiastic. No wonder. Navratilova has won the Australian Open three times, the French Open twice, and the U.S. Open four times. And Wimbledon, including singles, doubles, and mixed doubles, she holds 20 Wimbledon titles. Nobody holds more, only Billie Jean King holds as many. Martina Navratilova's pro career began in 1975, and at 49, she looks as if she could play on into her 50s, if she so chose. Instead, she has said she will retire after this tennis season. When the last of Navratilova's fans had left the building, I had an opportunity to ask her about the book most of them were carrying away, Shape Yourself, subtitled My Six-Step Diet and Fitness Plan to Achieve the Best Shape of Your Life. I wondered why, having already written or perhaps co-written two mystery novels set in the world of pro tennis, she had turned to self-help.
Well, I sort of didn't have a choice. I was asked so many times, how come I can still play tennis? How come I can still run so fast? How come I look so good without any surgeries? And I realized I knew a lot more about the subject than I thought, and I thought I should really put it down on paper so I can share the pitfalls and what I've learned, the good and the bad, and pass it on.
So the process of discovering that you knew more than you thought you did is just over the years discovering what you have
Absolutely.
To do to keep churning along.
Absolutely. I mean, I've really been taking really good care of my body since 1981. For the last 25 years, I've been really doing all the good things for it. Of course, I have some privileges that come with being a professional athlete and having a lot of money, but still a great majority of what I do can be done by anyone at any level, financially or economically and lifestyle-wise. It's all doable. So I just really wanted to for people sort of to give them the guide of how they can make those changes to help their own lifestyle, because I think most of us just look on the outside, we don't look on the inside enough, and this book is more of a comprehensive look at your life and what you like, what you don't like, what you can change now, what you can perhaps change later, and how to implement those changes.
It's interesting to me that you pinpoint 1981. Was there a conscious decision? Did you look around and say, wow, if I'm going to continue to compete at this level, I better start taking care of myself? Did something happen to provoke that recognition?
Well, what happened was that I realized I didn't have forever as far as an athlete, because I always figured I would play till I'm 30 years old, and then I'll probably do something else. And my time was running out. I was 26, and I hadn't really achieved things that I wanted to achieve in my career, and I really wanted to get better. And in order to do that, I had to sort of take care of everything, not just the tennis part, but off the court part as well, which of course included eating properly. I didn't need to lose any weight. I weighed the same since, about 145 pounds. I'm about 150 now. But for the last 20 years of my career, I weighed the same. I just needed for it to be better quality. So I got into nutrition and, of course, more cross-training, working out with weights and playing basketball, running on track, and then implementing a coach. So I sort of had a team of people that really helped me get myself together.
It's very interesting to me that you had that sort of recognition when you were 26. I haven't accomplished what I would like to accomplish, and I may not have all the time in the world mm-hmm. to do it. Was there a point in your career where it suddenly occurred to you that if you applied yourself and worked as hard as you possibly could, you might be the very best female tennis player who ever lived? Did that sort of dawn on you at some point?
No. At that point, it was that time in 81 when I just thought, okay, my time is running out, so I better get my act in order here. But how far that was going to take me, I didn't know. I just knew I needed to do it right then and there. You don't decide to be the greatest of all time, because that takes a long time. And that's not anything you can control, because, first of all, it's a subjective thing anyway. And second of all, you need huge time longevity for that.
You certainly have achieved.
Yeah, I have, but you can't control that. I mean, I could have been in a car accident or just, blow out my knee that was never going to heal. Stepped funny, broken a tibia, and there goes my career. So a lot of luck goes into that, but I also think you make your own luck, and the fact that I'm still in such great shape is not an accident. It is because of everything that I've done. Hmm. So longevity is a product of working at it for a long period of time. You can't just sort of do something right for a year and think that's going to carry you the rest of your life.
Is it scary to anticipate life without tennis at the top competitive level? Is that
no, not at all. It's very exciting. If it was scary, I would still be playing. I never play tennis out of fear. I play tennis because I love it, and I'm stopping to play because I love my life away from the tennis court, and I want to pursue that a lot further than I have been able to, particularly my private life, but also my business opportunities.
It just strikes me that to be a top athlete in any sport, whether a team sport or tennis or whatever it might be, the level of commitment is so extraordinary, not only to staying in shape, but I mean just the number of hours you have to spend practicing, the number of hours working on the psychology of having yourself at the top of your game every time you play is so extraordinary, such a commitment that to get beyond that, it must be kind of a kind of curious sensation of knowing, well, I'm not going to be thinking of myself as a pro tennis player any longer.
Well, the commitment is so strong that it really takes over your life. It's not just about the time you spend on the tennis court or training and all that, but it's also not even going out to dinner when you want to go out to dinner because you need to save your energy for the next day. If that's what you want to do, that's fine. But I'm at the point in my life where I don't want to do that anymore. I want to spend more time with my one and only, and I want to be able to go to the movies when I want to go to the movies, not when I possibly can. I mean, this year I've been so busy, I think I've gone to the movies 3 times, you know. So that's not the life that I want, and that's my favorite thing to do with my honey. So I am not scared at all or worried about what retirement will bring, because first of all, it's not retirement. I just won't be playing tennis.
It's only retirement from tennis, but absolutely, there's lots of other things to look forward to.
Lots of things to do. I'm promoting the book. I really want to spread the word and have people get the idea that they can also have better quality of life. And I also have a rainbow card, which I co-founded 10 years ago. Which is a credit card that raises money for the gay and lesbian organizations around the country through its work with the Rainbow Endowment. So I'm very active with that. I want to take it international, going into Canada this summer, and hopefully going to Europe next year, and really want to help make a difference in the gay and lesbian community. So I'll be very busy.
Yeah. You're going to have your hands full.
I'll have my hands full. Absolutely. To say the least.
Now, just one last question. Do you anticipate, now that you are retiring, getting cards and letters from the various women against whom you played when you were in your 20s and your 30s saying, hey, it's about time, you know?
Well, the ones that are playing, like, for example, at Wimbledon, we have the 35 and over for women. And I saw one of the players, and she's about 5 years younger than I am. She says, well, when you're 60, maybe you can play with us. Because I'm really pushing the boundaries when it comes to age. I mean, in these Grand Slams, we have the 35 and over for women and 35 and 45 and over for men. You know, I get so many compliments from them, and that's what really makes me realize how special it is what I'm doing, because these are men and women who have had, like, hip replacements, you know, and knee replacements, and you know, they're sort of walking around with a limp, and they just can't believe what I'm doing. So that's what makes me feel good, that I'm doing something right. And again, that's why I sort of was forced into writing that book.
Kind of fun to push boundaries.
Yes, it is. I question authority. Definitely do. And then when somebody says do something, and I'm like, well, why? You know, is this a good thing or a bad thing? I always question it, and that's why I got in trouble in Czechoslovakia. That's why I get in trouble in the United States. You know, I criticize what I don't like, or I speak up for what I think is right and what I think is wrong. And so I always push those boundaries, and I suppose I always will.
Tennis fans will have another opportunity to see Martina Navratilova in action when the Boston Lobsters take on the Delaware Smash on Monday night at Harvard University's Bright Arena. She'll also be playing in the U.S. Open next month in New York, but that's it. She promises. No kidding, really. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Ryman Simon Wood and from George the Conductor Hicks. Special thanks to Vince the Rogue Fairchild. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about West of Jesus, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from that elusive character eagerly sought by West of Jesus author Stephen Kotler, the conductor. Holy goofy foot, he really is out there. I'm Phil Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston and from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at WKKF.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation with a new website at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.